again the director of the biotechnology project at the Institute for Social Ecology.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks to Christine and others who invited me here. I'm going to speak with you for about 15 minutes about how we can bring these issues home. If you want to get more deeply into some of the questions around genetic engineering and trade and its relationship to world hunger, I'll refer you to my book that's for sale on the table downstairs called Gene Traders. But in discussing what to bring to this session, what I discussed with Christine was the question of how to bring these larger policy questions and international considerations into thinking about our food situation right here in northern New England. And the work that I'll be presenting was originally drafted with the perspective of looking at Vermont, which is where I'm based. But as we'll see as we go along, most of the principles apply very clearly to the region as a whole. And what I want to do is talk about some of the specific obstacles to food self-reliance here in northern New England, and then what we can do about it and what people in the region are doing about it. And there are just a few charts that I'll show about 5 minutes into it, but mostly I'm going to be just talking with you, doing it the old-fashioned way. I hope that's okay. If you go back to the early years of European settlement in this part of the continent, northern New England, and particularly north central Vermont, where I live, was considered the breadbasket of the region. Today, we think of the climate of Vermont and northern New England as a whole as being too harsh for a significant amount of our food to come from here. But if you look historically, you find that for most of the time European descended people have lived in this part of the country, that's really not been the case. What began to change things, of course, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries were the introduction of the railroads, the move toward Western migration, people being able to grow more food on less land as they moved west, and with that, the creation of a national grain market. And like any market, this was a creation that something that resulted from very specific policies, economic policies, systems of subsidies, as we heard, the development and support of transportation infrastructure to facilitate the creation of a national market in agricultural commodities, something that is by no means a given, all things being equal. If you look as recently as the 1950s, the average American household spent 30% of its income on food. Today, we're spending an average of about 15% of our income on food. How did that come to be the case? You have to look at policies that were implemented at the level of the USDA beginning in the 1950s. When studies were done at the federal level that concluded that we had an excess rural population in the U.S. There were too many people living on the land supporting themselves by growing food. And this was antithetical to the interests of creating a consumer-based economy, creating the kind of suburbanization that became the norm in the 50s. Of course, the huge increase in housing costs over the last couple of generations are in many ways a result of the fact that policies have been structured in such a way to reduce the amount of money that we spend on food. During that same period of time, Vermont in particular lost 90% of its farms. We have a tenth as many farms in Vermont as we had a generation ago. I'm sure many of you have heard the statistic that's commonly bandied about, that the average food item that we eat in the United States has traveled 1,200 miles from farm to table. What I really just recently discovered is that that statistic goes back to the late 1960s. So if you think about how much more food we're getting from longer and longer distances, I think it's pretty clear that if that statistic were to be redone, that the average distance our food travels would be very much more than that. One of the main driving factors in this whole development is increased corporate control over our food supply. And in a minute, we're going to look at the charts. First, I want to point out that you can trace patterns of corporate control by looking at patterns of pesticide use, because the production of agricultural chemicals and the control over the way our food is grown that's come from the production and distribution of agricultural chemicals is one of the key factors that's driven corporate control. Pesticide use increased tenfold during the 1950s, beginning with the introduction of DDT in the late 40s, immediately following World War II, to the mid 50s. It's increased, pesticide use has increased another tenfold since then. And on the chart, you can see the implications of that for not just concentration in pesticide production, but how it directly translates into where our seeds come from. You can see that many of the companies that over the last 10 years have come to control the world's seed supply are those very companies in the agrochemical sector that have emerged as the top players. And of course, genetic engineering is a technology that has very much accelerated that process of consolidation, because overwhelmingly the largest share, and this always gets lost in the propaganda you see about genetic engineering and its so-called benefits, I would argue that there are none. They're continually obscuring the fact that 80% of the genetically engineered crops grown in the world today are engineered to do one thing, and that is to allow crops to resist ever-increasing doses of chemical herbicides, of weed killers. And the major producers of those herbicides are the companies that are now the dominant players in both chemical production and seed production. A generation ago, the idea of a global market in seeds was virtually unheard of and almost unimaginable. In the last 10 years, through a result of a huge wave of corporate buyouts, companies like Monsanto going around the world and looking for seed companies to buy and to increase their influence in their various societies, we now have a situation where these 11 companies control, I think the figure is something, is close to 30% of the world's supply of seeds. Monsanto just became number one in seeds over the last year as a result of its purchase of a Mexican company called Seminis, which isn't very well known, but it was the, and continues to be, the single largest producer of vegetable seeds in the entire Western Hemisphere. So Monsanto, which is number five in pesticides, it happens to be number two in herbicides, which are the crucial factor in terms of the dependencies created by their genetically engineered so-called Roundup Ready, that is ready to be sprayed with more and more and more Roundup herbicide seeds. They've become number two in herbicides. Syngenta is kind of a synthetic company, and we'll see it in a minute in the next chart, where they came from, a long series of buyouts and mergers and spin-offs over the last 5 years. Created this company that's number two in pesticides, number one in specifically herbicides. Bayer has been, it's known, it's thought of primarily as a drug company, but Bayer has been the world's largest manufacturer of insecticides going back 50 or 60 years. So, tremendous synergy between seed production and chemical production, driven by and also feeding the further development of genetic engineering. The next slide shows you
a little bit more of where these companies came from. And I hope you can see it. Yeah, we'll scroll down in a minute. Yeah, you can go down. It says 2003 up top because when I was doing this work, this chart was changing very rapidly. Every 6 months from the late 90s until 2003, this chart had to be redone because these companies and their ownership and very existence was constantly in flux. It stabilized pretty much since 2003. The Monsanto we know today is actually a much smaller company than the chemical giant that was in the top 10 of US chemical companies, beginning with the period immediately following World War I. It was a major war profiteer during World War I and has been ever since. I don't have time to say a lot about Monsanto, but I can refer you to some things I've written about them. Today's Monsanto is much smaller. It doesn't contain all its agrochemical, all its industrial chemical and pharmaceutical divisions. It is a company whose sole existence is the promotion of agricultural chemicals and increasingly questionable supply of seeds. They spent more than $10 billion from the late 90s to today buying up seed companies as fast as they could, and that's how they got to be number one in seeds. Bayer got into the genetic engineering business as a result of the second set of mergers. That resulted in a company called Aventis that's now entirely a drug company. When they were found to be responsible for the Starling corn fiasco of about 5 or 6 years ago, when a genetically engineered corn variety that had never been approved for human consumption was found to be contaminating corn products all over the country, as a result of various lawsuits and the cost of that, they sold Bayer, their so-called crop science division, and that's how Bayer got to be a major purveyor of GMOs as well as the biggest manufacturer of insecticides. Syngenta is the result of two sets of mergers and then a divestment when two, at the time, new companies, Novartis and AstraZeneca, also made the decision that in order to protect its pharmaceutical profits, it needed to spin off its agricultural business into a new company. And there's a lot to be said about every one of those original companies. Going back to Ciba Geigy, they were the original developer of DDT that really started the whole agrochemical revolution. Again, I can refer you to where I've written more about these companies and particularly the origins of many of them in wartime production and synergistic development of agricultural chemicals and chemical weapons. The next slide briefly looks at food retail, another area where there's been tremendous consolidation. There should be a way to blow that up. If you go under view, I think there's a zoom feature. There we go. Maybe once more. Yeah, there we go. There's also been tremendous concentration in the area of food retail. Walmart, of course, over the last half dozen years has become the world's single largest corporation, outdoing all the oil companies, all the major auto companies. They're the largest employer in the United States and now control 8% of the global market in groceries. Horrifying statistic. And of course, there's been a lot in the press lately about Walmart's move into organics and the potential implications of that for organic growers. The other two companies on this chart, just to point out, that are active in this region are Ahold, If you buy food from Stop and Shop, Stop and Shop is owned by Royal Ahold of the Netherlands, and Albertsons, which is currently for sale and is expected to be bought up by an even larger company, about 3 or 4 years ago purchased the Shaw's chain. So those are this region's contributors to this process of corporate consolidation. That's enough for the slides. We could trace the same development, and I'm getting the 5 minute thing already. We can trace the same development in the processing and distribution of food, and I can give you sources to go to on that. What I want to spend the rest of the time on is talking about what we can do about this. And my keystone for talking about what we can do about it is the concept of food sovereignty. The concept of food sovereignty has been popularized by a global alliance of small farmer organizations known as Via Campesina. Via Campesina represents probably 100,000 small farmers who are aware of these crucial issues around trade and globalization and corporate control that have been organizing worldwide. Via Campesina defines food sovereignty as people's fundamental right to define their own agricultural and food policies. And there are a number of things that come under that. It includes prioritizing agricultural production to feed people rather than for export. In most of the global south, the incursion of export-oriented agriculture has been a huge factor in the destabilization of rural communities. Protecting farmers' rights to land, water, seeds, and credit. And Via Campesina has been very much in the forefront of the battle worldwide for control over seeds. And the power to protect local agricultures from food dumping that we heard from Stephanie about a little earlier, the ways that subsidized commodity crops from major industrial countries are flooding markets in the global south and furthering the process of driving people off the land. I think it's important to note that these concepts emerge from the global south, where food production is still central to people's way of life. Here in the US, there are currently more people in prison than there are employed growing food, both less than 2% of the population. And I really want to move quickly into how we can reclaim control over our food and what we can do about it, and talk about some of the local experiments that are happening in this region and how these efforts can come together into larger coordinated efforts to both help us reduce our dependence on oil and other non-renewable resources and increase self-reliance at the local level. The very local, very specific examples that I want to mention are ones that you're all very familiar with and that there'll be more discussion of over the course of today. Farmers markets have been growing tremendously all over the United States, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, literally. CSAs, there's a whole session on later. I won't say anything more now about CSAs. Just over the last couple of years, the increasing popularity of local food as a phenomenon that people take very seriously. People might know about the local vor movement that started to catch on in Vermont and in the Connecticut Valley between Vermont and New Hampshire and other parts of the country, where people are trying for periods of time to pledge to eat food only grown within 100 miles of where they live. But what's more important, I think, are the ways that individual actions are starting to translate into change at the community level and on larger scales of society. And there are very specific policy interventions needed in order to facilitate these changes. The whole is often more than the sum of its parts. But facing those tremendous systems of corporate consolidation, we need to coordinate our efforts much more and to be much more engaged in fighting for changes in policy that facilitate moving toward a more sustainable future. Things like school gardens and farm-to-school programs. There was a bill passed in Vermont earlier this year that provides a little bit of money to help facilitate farmers getting their produce into schools. The other side of the original proposal was to help the people in the school kitchens figure out what to do with the food, because of course school kitchens are very much organized around bulk quantities of processed, tasteless, nutritionally useless products that are constantly coming into their kitchens, and helping them make that transition is something that ended up getting cut out of the bill at the last minute. Support for organic transitions. It's something we hear a lot about in Vermont, but at the level of the state administration, it's pure lip service. In Europe, on the other hand, farmers are subsidized to convert to organic. It's a huge, been a huge factor in the rise of organic agriculture in the UK. In Austria, during the 1990s, there was a tenfold increase in the number of organic farms, and that was directly related to public support for farmers converting to organic. Another area that people are starting to experiment with is zoning. Zoning is one of the few things we really have control over at the local level. In New England, over the last 3 or 4 years, over 110 towns have passed resolutions opposing the use of GMOs, supporting labeling and moratoria. But in most New England towns, we don't have a lot of power. One of the powers we have is over zoning, and people are starting to look into ways to use that not only to deal with GMOs, but to address the issue of commercial development and housing development on prime agricultural land. And are there ways that zoning can be used to prevent that, to keep food in use, to keep the land in use? I was going to say, let me just mention briefly a study that's currently being worked on at the University of Vermont by a graduate student named David Timmons, really looking at the potential for food self-reliance state by state around the country. And I won't go into the details except to say that the figures for Vermont look pretty good. Vermont currently has the capacity to meet 40% of its food needs. Since so much of the food that we grow is exported, the real figure is close to 15%. In New Hampshire, it actually doesn't look so good, current capacity. In New Hampshire is only to grow 5% of its food. And I think it's important to look at why that's the case. I want to conclude by saying that the most important thing for me, this awareness of food self-reliance and the need to reduce dependence on oil have grown tremendously in communities all over the country, but we really need to think about what we can do in our communities to move this process forward and to do it in a way that's inclusive, so that local food doesn't become a luxury item that people who are most well off can afford, whereas people who are less well off are eating food that's more and more toxic, more and more genetically engineered in its ingredients, and less able to sustain life. So this is an ongoing process, and I hope all of you will find ways to become engaged with it. Thank you.